Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander, and once again, I would like to welcome our listeners to the Socialist Insight. And today we have Bob Maskey. He's joining the program once again. We've been having Bob on quite frequently lately. He's an excellent guest, very knowledgeable about left issues. And in addition to that, Bob has just recently introduced a program that he's doing more or less on a trial basis, but I look forward to myself joining that program from time to time. Bob, thanks again for joining the program.
Thanks for asking me, Stuart.
Well, Bob, what we're going to get into today, we're going to be discussing a little bit about the scoring the Obama presidency. President Obama, he made certain promises in 2007 and 2008, and he took office in 2009. And even surprisingly, much of the left supported Obama in 2012 in his reelection. And many people say, well, you know, he needs to have a second term to clean up the mess that President Bush that he created. But now we're past the midway point, and even almost 7 months into 6 months into his second term. So, Bob, what we're going to do today, we're going to do a little bit of scoring in regards to, and this is, when I say independent, this is going to be an independent scoring of you basically. I'm going to ask you a question where you can give an answer, and we're going to score from 1 to 10, 10 being the best. And then we're going to sort of add that up based on the number of questions and see. I think you're a very fair representative of the left. And definitely, you're a very fair representative of the socialist thought, and we're going to see how that scores. Bob, first of all, we have seen this economy under Obama. Nothing has really changed that much since Obama took office and took the reign from President Bush. Basically, what we have seen is a very transaction president. In other words, he's handling various transactions transitional from the previous President Bush. But in regards to the economy, President Obama promised that he was going to create jobs, shovel-ready jobs, good-paying jobs for the young, for many of the seniors, for the vets. But, Bob, where does the president come in regards to that promise that he made in 2007 and 2008, if he was elected president, that he was going to create shovel-ready, good-paying jobs for people here in this country?
Well, yeah, I'm going to slightly disagree with one thing you said, and that was that he didn't change anything from Bush. What he changed was and I hate to be defending Obama, but you know we're going to try to be honest here too, right?
Sure.
Bush had a rapidly falling economy. We were crashing.
Right.
We were heading down. We were heading down really fast. Obama
right.
stopped it and evened it out. He didn't
now, how did
improve
he do
it very much. He, you know, I mean, you probably couldn't see too much of a difference between 2010 and, you know, 2008. But, you know, he did stop the slide. He did stop he didn't do it the way you and I probably would have done it, with massive job programs, with massive money going into the infrastructure, building high speed rails.
But he did create a lot of debt, correct?
Right. He did a lot of debt, and he gave a lot of money to his friends and to the people who contributed to him. He built up the stock market. Stock market going crazy. Everybody's making money at the stock market. But he did very little for the average working person.
Okay. So when you say he stopped the slide, how did how would we give him credit for stopping the slide when, you know, basically it seems more like a seesaw? In other words, you know, you say he stopped the slide. It wasn't going down one way, but it was going up in the other direction. How did he stop the slide?
Well, you know, he
because obviously we can see that Wall Street has done a tremendous job bouncing back.
Yeah.
They're at an all-time high.
Yeah. Well, you know, the stimulus at first. The stimulus was necessary. I mean, it was, you know, but we needed a lot more. I mean, he did almost, it almost seemed like he tried to do the bare minimum to keep everything from crashing around us. That's almost what it seems like to me.
And now, how much of that stimulus would you say benefited working people? We understand that it was a benefit to Wall Street. But, you know, we're looking at it from a worker's perspective. How the economy bouncing back, we can look at that two ways. Did it bounce back for Wall Street, or did it bounce back for working people?
Well, when you give money to rich people, they end up, you know, trickling down a little bit. I mean, it's not, you know, trickle down is true in a way. It's just that it's a very small percentage that trickles down. You know, people have lost their jobs. People, there is still a social safety net out there to hold people together a little bit. You know, he hasn't tried to help anybody on the lower levels. He's tried to help his friends and thereby kept some jobs going. I mean, I wouldn't give him high marks for his economy.
What has he done for, like, small – what would be your opinion in regards to what he has done for small businesses and people, you know, working people that many of us that work out of our homes – so I'm working out of our garages. But the small business person, how has he actually – we know he has been a major benefit for the big corporations, but what about the smaller businesses that you even see in your communities where you live? I believe you live in San Bernardino, correct?
Yeah. I don't think he's done anything. I mean, I don't think he's done anything for small businesses. He hasn't tried. That's not his people. I mean, his people are the wealthy and the big corporations. His people are the oil companies and GM. But, you know, we can't forget that GM does employ people, and the oil companies do employ people. So some people have benefited very small, trickle-down kind of a way through some of his giveaways to the rich, but not very much, and certainly not in as much as he's given out.
Okay, so under the economy, under Bush, and believe me, I'm not defending Bush, but were we headed for a crash, or was that just a little bit more BS? Because, I mean, we always hear about the sky is falling, and Bush, you remember, he received $750 billion to stop the sky from falling. He spent just a little over $300 billion of that, and the rest he left in reserves for Obama to add to his $787 billion, and then we saw much of that go to Wall Street. So basically, when we look at, you know, under Bush and under Obama, when I say transitional, seemed like he just more or less picked up from where President Bush left off.
I'd agree with that. I'd agree with that. I mean, you know, the Bush almost did it accidentally. I mean, you know, Bush didn't know what to do. He kind of just, I think, followed the advice of the economists around him, who said, you know, if you don't rescue this banking system, we have a huge problem here. So he rescued the banking system. Obama continued it. If they hadn't, we were heading to I'm pretty sure it would have been worse than the 1930s.
Okay, so where would you rate? Looking at this president, where would you rate him on the economy on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the best, where would you rate him?
Well, when we compare it to, say, a 10 would be what – or even a 9 would be what you and I would do, right? Massive job programs, massive, you know, infrastructure improvements, massive, you know, conservation programs, all this kind of stuff as a 9 – what he – Roosevelt saying, you know, FDR being maybe a 6 – With Obama, you can't give him much more than a 2 or 3.
Okay, so we'll be generous here. We'll give him a 3 on that one. Okay.
Okay, that's generous.
What else would you like to just add before we move on to the next area? What would you like to add in regards to anything else on Obama's rating for the economy? What could he or should he have done that he did not do? And could, I want to ask you, could, do you think it was possible, Bob, for the president, based on his promises, was it possible for him to truly deliver on those big promises?
Well, I think you bring this is a point I kind of wanted to make at some time too, is that we can't separate Obama from his party. That we're not just grading Obama here; we're grading the Democratic Party too.
Good point. Very good point.
Yeah, right, because if we don't do that, then you know Hillary's going to come along in a couple of years and say, "Well, I'm not Obama," right?
Right, exactly.
So we have to make sure that you know Obama is not in a vacuum. He's an individual within the party. He's head of that party, but that party has been moving in a certain direction for a long time. They are for privatization. They are for
right.
You know they aren't doing very much for unions. They're doing very little to restrain Wall Street. You might have a couple of people out there like Elizabeth Warren, a couple, and I mean like one or two or three, that are in leadership positions in that party who are actually trying to do something. That's not enough, and that's certainly not reflective of the party.
Okay, so and that's very fair. It's also the party. The next thing what I'm going to want to look at, which this is has a lot to do with that, but when we look at the economy, obviously everyone's looking at creating jobs. How well has the president done as far as job creation under his administration? And that's very much tied into the economy. But how well has he done? Not just shovel-ready jobs, because we see a lot of people working in the private sector that they're working part-time jobs. In many cases, we can see that more jobs have been created, but those jobs are part-time jobs. Jobs paying minimum wage, but how has he done in regards to creating job creation?
You know, again, I don't think this. I think the stimulus was a decent start, and he should have followed up on it. He got pushed back by the right with the stimulus. They started really ridiculing it. And I think this is very typical for what happens with Obama is that the right wing, which you know he's pretty much a part of. I mean, he's certainly not left of center here. That they start pushing back and they start ridiculing him, and he doesn't respond as we might expect a president to respond. He backs off. He goes in the other direction. So, well, maybe not even the other direction. He just doesn't continue what he was doing before. So, while the stimulus was good and it should have been, you know, a lot more, and a lot more should have come down the pike as time went on, he didn't do that. He gave it all up. Mm-hmm. And he used as an excuse, the Republicans aren't going to let me do it. But he didn't come to everybody and say, hey, we need this. Look, this has worked so far. We need to do more. There were plenty of people who were ready to speak up for him. A lot of liberals and a lot of Democrats were ready to speak up for him and to push for it. He's the one who didn't push for it.
I see. So how would you rate the president on jobs? On a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate the president on job creation in the last 4.5 years?
I'd give him a start at 2, at 4 with the stimulus, and then maybe go to 2 after that.
Okay.
I mean, you know, so if you want to
we'll go with another 3 on that.
Yeah.
Started with a 2, 4, and right in the middle, I'll be right at 3.
I'm expecting a thank you letter from the White House for giving him these high grades.
Okay. Bob, one of the things that's very important for many of those on the left, including myself, and for years, you know, I worked as an environmentalist. I worked in Florida with the Florida Consumer Action Network, where we were working to clean up the much of the contamination that was happening throughout the state of Florida. They have a very fragile aquifer there, where salt water intrusion from various chemicals going into the soil, potential damage to the environment. But we see that this president, when it comes to, you know, climate change, and we look at how serious, or I should say, how he does not take climate change very serious. But in addition to that, we can see they have a project there coming from Canada down to Texas, which is a Keystone XL project. which the president has basically put his stamp of approval, and his party has put their stamp of approval on that. We can see also many of the environmental regulations have been relaxed. We can see what happened with British BP in the Gulf, and now basically they have gotten support from the federal governments, and the federal government has not held them accountable for the damage that they created to the environment there in the Gulf and the Gulf region. But, Bob, where does the president stand in regards to protecting the environment?
He should be standing in the corner. He's a bad president.
Standing in the corner. Time out.
Okay. I think you could guess where I would rate him on this. Let's get that one out of the way right away. He doesn't even deserve a one. All right. I mean, and you missed, I think, I mean, aside from climate change, which is huge, which he's offered nothing but a couple of small band-aids for, I think you might have missed one of the major ones, which is the meltdown in Japan of the nuclear power plant. With all that radiation.
Very, very big. And also, we're not even talking about that. Good point that you brought up there, Bob. But anyway, go on.
Well, you know, it's polluting the Pacific. You know, the Pacific isn't roomed off. There's not walls in the Pacific. You can't section it off. I mean, this is polluting the entire Pacific Ocean, the fish stock,
and the North
wildlife.
American continent.
Yeah, absolutely. And the radiation
is
going global.
We're not even talking about this.
Yeah, and nobody's talking about it. They've turned off the monitors. They don't warn us when the radiation is coming here. Our children are being born with thyroid problems here in the West Coast. The milk is poisoned. They've raised the bar on what is too much radiation. And rather than confronting the issue and rather than telling people not to be drinking the milk because that might actually burp the economy a little bit, they've actually raised the amount of acceptable radiation like about 8 times what it used to be so that they don't have to take it off the shelves. This is huge, and in 15 years, we're going to find out how huge it is. It's going to take at least that long, I'll bet you, unless we get another Snowden out there. It's going to take 15 years to figure out how bad this is, and I'm going to bet you it's going to be criminal behavior.
A lot of people also don't understand when a disaster takes place, like what took place there in Japan. Bob, it's thousands of years before that contamination is cleared up. Thousands of years.
Yep.
And here, you know, they're withholding information as if it's okay. But this is what we see in a capitalist society. In other words, they create the mess and then they tell you it's okay. But anyway, Bob, as you mentioned, that is a big one there. And what are some of the other areas in regards to the environment?
Well, the point is he is... You know, for anybody who still believes he's some kind of a progressive or some kind of a liberal, I don't even think he can be called a liberal anymore. I mean, I don't even think he can be called a conservative because conservatives should care about the environment. So, you know, he is just solely for the profits of the big corporations, it seems to me. I mean, why aren't we addressing nuclear power? After that, and after they pollute, this is cross-border pollution from Japan to the United States, thousands and thousands of miles away. We're not addressing that. The American people haven't woken up to this fact. What should have happened is we should have, you know, immediately closed down half of our nuclear plants and planned on closing the rest of them down, you know, embarked on another massive JOD program to build solar plants and windmills and whatever else we can replace nuclear
good
power
point.
With. You know, we
Very
didn't do
point.
Any of that. Why don't we do the most common sense things out there instead of, I mean, we are talking about see, you're getting me excited here, Stuart, you know?
No, you're gone. Take over the
show. We're talking about the survival of the planet. Why are we worried about short-term profit?
Right. No, good, very good points. Bob, what you mentioned, that was very critical. As a person as a left, and on the left, myself running as a presidential candidate, I would have looked at it as my task to start shutting down nuclear power plants across the country. As you mentioned, immediately half would have been shut down right away. All those in the coastal areas would have been within that first half. I probably would have been looking at a 36-month window to close all the rest of them down.
Yeah.
Bob, we don't have to wait for disasters to take place and to put human lives at risk to make a decision that it's time to take action. And that's what is happening right here. But as I mentioned, that's a big one there. What about this project, the Keystone XL project, bringing for the petroleum industry and those tar sands, bringing those up from Canada down to Texas? There's a certain risk that is being created there, not only for humans but also for the environment as well. And the president has put his stamp of approval on this project, which millions of people have objected to this project. But the president has basically said, it's okay. His administration, it's okay. Congress is saying, it's okay. The Democrats and the Republicans are standing side by side to say, it's okay. What about that project, Bob?
I think the question is a much bigger one. And to sum up my idea on this is that if capitalism was forced to pay for the damage it did, if it was forced to clean up the Pacific from the nuclear power plant, the Fukushima plant, if it was forced to clean up the environmental damage the BP caused to New Orleans and the Gulf, if it was forced to clean up all these places, all these Superfund sites and everything that the government ends up running into and cleaning up for everybody, if capitalism and the capitalists, the wealthy, were forced to actually pay through this or to even pass the cost on to consumers, capitalism would collapse. It can't do it. You know, and that's why things don't get cleaned up. What's that?
It would be bankrupt. They pass the cost off onto future generations. But as you mentioned, it would be bankrupt.
Right. So that's what I think about the pipeline. It's the same thing. You know, the pipeline, we look at this somewhat small issue. I mean, compared to global climate change, compared to the nuclear power meltdowns, the XL pipeline is a smaller issue, but it exemplifies where they come from.
It's smaller, but it's still big, especially for the people that are living within those areas. But when you look at a global scale, on a global scale, these other issues, especially when we're talking about nuclear radiation that is going across the Pacific and North America and spreading across the globe, and we're not even talking about this.
Right.
When it comes to the environment,
it's almost kind of weird, isn't it?
What,
I mean, the XL pipeline is not a global catastrophe. It's horrible. It's anti-environment. It shouldn't be done. It's not a global problem. It's not going to lead to the end of the planet and humanity like climate change might, like the nuclear meltdowns might. So, I mean, I just don't want to keep them on the same page. You know, I mean, I want to belittle the pipeline and people who are bravely standing against it, but let's use it as more of an example of how capitalism works and doesn't work. And capitalism isn't going to clean up any mess that makes.
When it comes to the environment, what, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the best, where would you rate this president?
And we can't go in negative numbers here, right?
The lowest we can go is 0.
Well, then give him a 0 on it.
I want to be fair. 0.
See, now, if I didn't give him 3s before, people wouldn't have believed my 0.
Okay. So where do we stand? Are we at 0 or somewhere between 0 and 3?
I think you said 1 to 10, so we're at 1 on the environment, right?
Right, you're right. Yeah. 1 to 10. Bob, again, we already touched on the economy. We already touched on creating jobs. One of the things on the left we're very concerned with is the support for, you know, we support organized labor. And the president, when President Obama ran for office in 2007 and 2008, not only did he receive a great amount of support from organized labor, but he had mentioned how he would be supportive of unions and labor organizing in this country, and labor stood in force behind him and supported him with contributions. But we can see that the president has had some tremendous failings in this area. But where do you see the president where he has offered any type of support for unions, organized labor, and also working people in this country, with the emphasis on organized labor? Because we believe on the left, organized labor, that's a right that we should have in the workplace.
You know, not only, you know, to be a little more specific, he promised card check. He promised that he was going to put card check in when he was elected, or he was at least going to try to put card check in. And card check would have allowed people to sign up for a union without having to deal with all the company propaganda. All they would have had to do was sign a union card. It would have been great. This is one of the reasons the unions jumped behind him so much. He also promised at one point he wasn't just going to support labor unions. He was going to walk picket lines. He said he would be on the picket lines with them.
Has he even done that once since he's been elected?
No.
He didn't even try
card check.
Right, exactly. I haven't seen him moving anywhere in that left direction.
No, nowhere. But you know, you kind of touched on I think what I think is the big problem here. And again, we kind of have a habit of separating organized labor from the Democrat Party.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not.
Oh, good point.
The Democrats are organized labor. I mean, they are part of that coalition that makes up the Democrats' party. And, you know, it's the leadership. They are out of touch with a lot of the leadership. Most of the leadership is out of touch with their rank and file. But, you know, that is their party. They have nobody else to support. It's not like they're going to jump away and, you know, suddenly threaten to support Republicans. They have too much invested in that party. And that's
well, you know what it seems like to me, Bob, is that the super rich, and we look at in this global economy, especially where it pertains to this country, people think of the left and they think of the Democrats. But basically, what the Democrats have been used for over the decades is a means to absorb the working class, to absorb union, absorb the left. Any type of movement on the left, the Democrats it works like as a sponge to absorb,
yep.
And then on the other end, they don't produce anything.
Right. Yep. All they do is take the anger.
Pardon me.
All they do is take the anger and dissipate it. You know, they give a good speech, or they say, hey, we're going to, you know, introduce this legislation, and then they let it all drop as soon as nobody else is looking. But again, the leadership of organized labor has to take some responsibility for the Democratic Party. It has to. I mean, they're the ones who helped build this party, and they don't seem – I don't want to dump on organized labor, certainly, but I don't think they're capable. They're able to stop it. I think I don't think they're a big enough part of that party anymore. You know, I think at one time they were, and things were pretty much a lot better when they were. But I think Wall Streeters, I think bankers, I think the wealthy, the big corporations are now running the Democratic Party, and they put up with organized labor being part of it as long as organized labor doesn't get a controlling interest in the party. They'll be a part of it.
I see. When it comes to unions and working, how the President Obama has supported working people, 1 to 10, 10 being the best, how would you rate the president's support on supporting organized labor, workers, and unions?
Well, being generous, a 1, because he's actually not even
generous.
Done what he promised he was going to do.
I think that's more than fair.
You know, he didn't do card check. He didn't try to do card check. I mean, you know, he didn't even propose it. He just dropped it.
Right.
You know, he never stood in a picket line. He never, you know, I would be more surprised if he stood in a picket line than if he crossed one.
Now, this one is going to be a little bit ambiguous. And the reason why I'm saying that, because depending on how you're looking at this and what side you're on, he's done a great job fixing the economic system, Wall Street, and banking reform. reform. Bob, I'll just let you elaborate on this. How how well has the president done? Because if I go and ask a Wall Street banker, and if I ask the super rich, which they're citizens of, many of them are citizens of this country, and if you look at it from the perspective of Wall Street, I'll let you go and elaborate on this. How well has the president done, President Obama done, on fixing the economy? Because we've already talked about how he's fixed the economy for working people.
Yes.
But I don't know how you would want to, give your emphasis on this, fixing the economic system, Wall Street, and the banking reform.
You know, there's an old script writing abbreviation, POV, point of view. It all depends on your point of view, right? It's,
okay.
You know, if you're wealthy, if you're a stockbroker, and he's probably getting an eight or nine right now, right? Unless you're a racist, unless color matters more to you than profits, and there are people like the Koch brothers like that, right? I mean, unless you're a racist or you're just a far right winger or a homophobe, you could excuse all those. As a wealthy person, you could excuse them for putting money into your pocket in Wall Street. You know, I love talking to a lot of Democrats. A lot of diehard Democrats cannot argue with a left winger, somebody who's actually
right.
A left winger or a socialist. They want to use the same arguments they use against conservatives against us, which doesn't work. So
right.
I often hear them come out to me and say, "Well, if he's such a socialist, why is the stock market going so crazy?" Well, he's not a socialist.
Good
why
point.
Do we want the stock market to be going crazy? Isn't the stock market going crazy what led to the recession?
Right, exactly. Out of control, crazy.
Yeah. So, I mean,
now,
I don't know if that's another point to grade
now,
or not.
Now, the way I'm going to – now, the second part of this question, Bob, and this is the way we're going to, use the grading on this one, is that when Obama was speaking to various audiences and to people as he was running for office in 2008, and we could see that the nation was on the verge of the collapse had already begun, but there were promises that the president was making that he was going to fix this economic system and he was going to bring these fat cats on Wall Street
yep.
under control and rein them in. So based on the promises that he made in regards to making banking reforms and dealing with Wall Street, how well has the president done in regards to keeping his promises to his constituents? Now, let me not say his constituents, because we know who his constituents are. But in regards to the people, the people that he was speaking to when he was doing his tours in 2008, how well has he kept his promise in regards to fixing the economy in Wall Street?
You know, I think at the very beginning he started mildly offering some reforms and did some reforms. I think I don't think he had to go to Congress for all of them. I think there were, a lot of them were regulations and such that they were able to do by themselves, and he put them in. And it's almost humorous how quickly they're falling out already. They're already
right.
changing them. They're already getting rid of those. You know, I don't even know why this would make sense to wealthy or corporations or people who have to do the stock market, where it basically is just setting itself up for failure again. I mean, without these kind of reforms, and these reforms were mild, and they have proven themselves to be important for a fair trading market for the wealthy. And they don't
right.
even want that. They're almost saying, we want the wealthier of the wealthy to be able to take advantage of us. So I don't understand what's going on. We keep hearing about people making fun of the Tea Party and how the Republicans are becoming racist, homophobes, screaming and everything. Well, I see the Democrats are being much more calm about it, but they're doing crazy stuff too. I mean,
they're doing stupid stuff.
Yeah, it makes no sense. I mean, if I can see this, why can't they see this? If you can see it, why can't they see this? I mean, it's going to happen. It's if they don't put these reforms in, reforms that have proven themselves since the Great Depression, it's going to happen again.
Do you think it's possible, really, for any president to reform, in this country, to reform Wall Street? Because essentially, Wall Street and the super rich, in this country, they basically they're running Washington D.C.
Right.
But I'm just asking your opinion on it. Is it possible, in your opinion?
I think that's that is the point. What you made was the point here. Can anybody do it? Is this? And again, I don't think we can just dump on Obama. I mean, he's just
right.
an individual. How much could he really have done? I don't want to make excuses for him. And you know, it's even more than just the Democratic Party. I mean, you know, we can't just blame everything on them. I mean, this has been a long-term commitment since the 1930s, 1940s, a long-term commitment of the wealthiest people to corrupt our political and economic system.
Because
that's what it is.
That's a good point that you make that you're making, Bob. Because when you look at the president and when you look at Congress, the fat cats on Wall Street, the richest people, the capitalists, and when I say the capitalists, the richest people in our community, they own Congress.
Right.
They own this president. They installed this president. And it's a choice of either he try to keep his promises and do what fulfill the promises that he made and lose his job, or keep his job and do what they want him to do. So
I think it might even be he can do a little bit. He could do a little bit, like, you know, take Obamacare, right? I mean, he couldn't get national health. Maybe. I mean, I'm guessing here. Maybe he couldn't get it through. Maybe there were people who were.
He couldn't even get an option in there.
Well, he didn't even try. He dropped that pretty quick. But what he did
he
got, like, no pre-existing conditions in there, right? Which was
right.
important, and especially important. You know, I'm getting older. I have pre-existing conditions. I'm glad that that's going to be in there.
Same here.
So I'm glad, and I think he sets the bar too low, and I think he has a lot more power than he thought he had, but I think he does try to say, okay, you're going to get all this money, you're going to get all this profit, we're going to give you everything we want, I'm just going to take this little scrap for the little people.
Right. Bob, in regards to fixing the economy, Wall Street, and the banks, in other words, reining them in, and we understand that he has limitations, so maybe we can – maybe you're off a curve on this one. But how would you rate the president in regards to his performance there?
Yeah, I'm going to set it
– 1 to 10, 10 being the best.
Yeah, I would go with that 2 again. I mean, you know, I'm almost tempted to say 3, but 2. I mean, even the reforms he put in were minor. You know, I mean, them alone weren't going to correct anything, you know, or fix anything long term. So,
Bob, we understand that war plays a major factor on the economy. It plays a major factor on the environment. When we look at the damage that we're doing to the environment, war. You know, the damage that war does throughout the world, it leaves a very big footprint on the global environment. But how well that's very important. So I want to preface it by saying that the climate, because I'm very concerned with how we protect our environment.
Mm-hmm.
But when we look at war, but we're also talking about human lives, and we can see that the president promised in 2008, this was a promise that he was very emphatic about saying that once he was elected, if I am elected president, I will have all of our troops, not some, all of our troops out of Afghanistan and Iraq within the first 9 months in office. Since then, we have seen that this president has gone on a global crusade for the super rich and have expanded U.S. imperialism in areas of the globe that many of us don't even understand.
Yep.
We have
yep.
more military installations and bases than we've had in the last 30 years. So when we look at this president and the promises that he made to end the wars, and we have seen that he has been expanding wars, and very to the contrary of what was bestowed on him when he was just elected president, receiving the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah, I know.
And even that committee is saying that we need to take this prize back. How has the president fared? How has he done in regards to keeping his promise to bring peace and not war?
Well, I mean, he's done horribly, and it's not just because of his promises compared to what he's done. It's because, like you said, you point out, he's expanded things. He's attacked other countries. I know we probably have, you know, a handshake and giggles going on with Pakistan, you know, that you know, okay, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and you're going to turn blind. You'll yell at us a little bit, but then, you know, we'll be all friends again. But, you know, he is every drone strike in Pakistan is a violation of that country's neutrality.
Every time,
you know, I mean, and Obama and the United States don't seem to have a problem with this. You know, when they thought they had Snowden on a plane in Europe, he got like collusion with two or three other European countries to try to, you know, land the Bolivian president. You know, I mean, these are acts of war.
Hijacked the plane of President Morales. Hijacked it. Air piracy.
And not only that, but he got, you know, four or five European countries to help him. You know,
exactly.
I mean, you know, as far as the moral point here, and you know, I'm horrified by drones. I am horrified. I'm not personally scared of drones. I'm not paranoid. You know, I don't see anything in them, you know, Satan wise or anything like that. I just, when I look at them and I think of the moral failings of a country that uses these almost indiscriminately against semi-targets and who cares about the collateral damage, that is a serious moral failing, not only for the president, but for anybody in this country who calls themselves American and doesn't stand up and say, wait a minute.
Well, the president, as we can see, is now they're creating their own reasons for going in and attacking sovereign governments. We could see the same thing with Libya and the same thing with Syria, and coming up with this nonsense that we're going to create a no-fly zone, and once they create the no-fly zone, the only thing that's flying are NATO jets.
Yep.
So, and we have gone from, and we see this throughout the Middle East, but Bob, we have seen under this president, we have expanded a war like no other president in the last 100 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, Bob, I mean, when I think about children, the lives of children being snuffed out for every drone that they send out, is that 18 lives of innocent lives are lost just to try to reach the one intended target.
Yep.
You know, and these are acts of war that we are just invading countries, and the American people are just standing back, and it's okay. And I shouldn't say standing back, because we see with a lot of the legislation that is coming out of Washington is just basically saying, well, you can't protest, and if you speak up against this is a violation, and basically they have put the American public on notice.
Yep.
They are on notice. Yep. But when it comes to war, Bob, and how would you rate this president?
Oh, again, a one. I mean, you brought up one that I hadn't even recalled, unfortunately, was Libya. I mean, that was an unprovoked,
that was a big one,
illegal act of war
illegal.
That he didn't go through Congress with. I mean, you know, for that alone, he should be getting a one. I mean, if only they had reined him in a little bit then,
well, that,
he might not
that
be.
Alone, he should have been impeached.
That's right. Absolutely. Yep.
So far we have covered six areas, and right now
he's, and you're getting me mad, Stuart.
Bob, well, you speak well of them. You're giving me food for thought here. Bob, now I'm going to cover a couple of areas here, and I might mention that when I had when the president was running for re-election, and this program was just starting in August of last year, and Ruth Ann can remember, people were coming in on the line, and they were coming to the defense of Obama and say, well, you know, you need to give him a chance.
Yep.
He didn't create these problems. You know, that's what they were saying. That's what they were saying in August of last year when we first started.
Yep.
And now no one's saying anything.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
So let's look at a couple of the areas here, okay?
You know, but I'm going to just point out with what you said, Stuart, they're also not abandoning the Democratic Party yet. You know,
oh,
they're
right.
Also now they're all looking at Hillary as this big hero that's that's going to come along and saying like it's going to be any damn different.
Right. She's just another Obama. You know, she's just a female, but you know, she's another Obama.
Yeah.
And like Obama was a Bush.
Well, you know, that actually might be a bit different, a bit better than being a Bill.
Good point again, Bob. You're on a roll today. You're on a roll. But okay.
Tell the folks
and
I've
seen so many
okay?
people when I go like in certain parts of Los Angeles. But Bill Clinton was the best president we have had since Roosevelt. I mean, I can't believe it. Like, oh boy, give me a break. The president has done well in a couple of areas, and you know one of the areas that I have to say in regards to very recently, well again it depends on how you want to look at it. Well, let me just go to one other area first: gay rights. How well has the president done with gay rights? I'll just separate the question I was going to propose to you.
Well, this is going to mess up that whole curve thing. Then, you know, if we bring
gay
rights, should we?
Maybe we should
get rid of the lowest number and the highest number, and then we'll have it. It'll work out better. But, you know, gay rights. I think he's been courageous with gay rights. I think he went beyond what he had to do. I think he went beyond, and I wish he had done it with everything that he supposedly was for. But you know, I mean, do I think that you would have been better? Yes, I do think you would have been better, but I can't take it away from him. I mean, he stuck his neck out. He pushed it. He almost to the point of embarrassing himself, I'm sure, in front of some people. And he's you know, the bad part, of course, is that now we've gotten rid of our best excuse to dodge the draft. But aside from that.
Right. You know. Now, some of the things he has done well with gay rights in the military.
Yep.
He has done very well with gay rights as far as protecting, you know, same-sex relationships to marry.
He's
basically
evolved.
What we can see in on all fronts that he has been on the side of the left in that particular area. But when it comes to gay, when it comes to protecting gay rights, how would you rate the president on gay rights?
I'd give him an 8. You know, I mean, and you know,
and
realizing that, you know, we can call this a left issue, but the gay community is not a homogenous community. I mean, there are many conservative gays out there. And I think that's why he was able to push this so much. Because I think even the conservatives realize that, you know, they have a substantial, probably even a, you know, they have very large closets in their party, let's say, okay? And I think that's why he's been successful, is because it is homosexuality is widespread, and it doesn't matter what political tendency you have, it's there.
And Bob, I'm just going to pause just for a second to mention that we have Bob Maskey. He's joining our program once again. He comes on quite frequently, and he speaks on many of the issues that are relevant to the left and also to working people. Today, what we're discussing is how well has President Obama done. He's past that halfway point, and he is approximately 6 months into his second term, and we're just doing a scoring to see how well this president has done. And Bob, once again, thanks for joining the program.
Thanks, Stuart.
Bob, we already covered gay rights. How well has the president done with women's rights?
I think he's going to get a passing grade on women's rights. I mean, two more women on the Supreme Court. I think that's big. I think that's really big, and I think that was going above and beyond too. I think probably most people expected him to appoint one woman, but he appointed two.
What about women in the workplace?
Well, let's take Obamacare and the birth control.
And also, while we think about women in the workplace, let's think about being able to bring some type fairness of wages based on work that is performed, because we can see that since he's been in office, that has been very stagnant.
I mean, I definitely see the point, but I think he's pushed more than any other president. I think he's done more. I think maybe it was by accident. I mean, you know, maybe the including birth control in the Obamacare and you know, he hasn't backed down on that. You know, the Catholic employees out there, our employers out there, are suing the government now, trying to get that out, saying it's a freedom of religion. They're contesting it. They're going to court over it. So I'd give him a passing grade on it. I don't think it's a great grade, and I don't think he certainly hasn't really addressed any of the structural problems, the kind of thing you're talking about. But he hasn't done that with racism either.
So. Well, anything six or below, that's not passing. So where would you rate
okay.
the president?
Oh.
Where would you rate the president on women's rights?
I'd give him a 4.
Okay. So he's got a 4 on that. Now, one of the things that you and I have talked about from time to time, and it's a very hot issue, and you are all over this, Bob, is the civil rights and also privacy. And this is something I think about every time I get on the phone, when you turn on your television. I mean, we have we live in a society now that when you turn on your computer, they know exactly what terminal where you're sitting. When you turn on your television, when you turn on a light switch in your home, when you get on your telephone, when you get on your cell phone, when you fill out information for employment, when you clock in at work, when you leave work, when you crank up your car, when you're driving down the street. Bob, do I need to go on and on? I could go on the surveillance. When you have, you know, cameras that are in the workplace, you're on this side of the street, but there's 10 other cameras looking at you from the other side of the street and from the intersection. And when you drive past various stations, such as here in Riverside and San Diego County, you cross various border checks, and you have bright lights there. When people go by, it's recording every car and everyone that's sitting in that car.
Yeah.
Bob, I could go on and on.
Yeah.
What is, in regards to protecting civil rights and privacy, which the president had mentioned that and also said he was going to have a transparent government.
Yep.
He was going to bring transparency. It's been anything but transparency. And the only transparency I see are the lives of every individual that lives in this country. Bob, don't get me started. Bob, how well has the president done on civil rights and privacy? Help me out here.
I don't think I have to. I think you did pretty good. Why don't you grade this one?
Okay, can I go to 0?
Yeah, well, wait a minute. You're changing the rules now.
I'll stick with a 1. I'll stick with a 1. I'll be generous. Okay, civil rights and privacy. Bob, let me just touch on just for a minute. We had one president came in with the Patriot Act, and under the cover of darkness in the middle of the night, we had another president, President Obama. He signed into law help me out here.
NDAA?
NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act. But, Bob, this has been This has destroyed the civil rights of every person, the civil rights and privacy of, and we have been taking steps back. Let me stop, Bob. So anyway, when it comes to civil rights and also privacy, boy, I could go on for another 30, 40 minutes on that one. We're going to give him a one.
And it deserves it. It deserves it.
We're going to be generous,
all these issues we're talking about deserve more time. The environment especially deserves more time, and so does the privacy issue deserve more time. You know?
Right. Bob, let's, you know, it's a lot of Democrats that are listening. People that support the Democratic Party. How well has this president done supporting his, leading his party, the Democrats?
You know, again, that's a kind of a, that depends on your POV, your point of view, right? I mean, if you're the
right.
you're the wealthy stockbroker who helped put him into office, or if you're the banker who we didn't put in jail, you know, I mean, then you're doing pretty good with leading that party, with leading it into a direction that it hasn't really been in, or hasn't at least openly been in the past. I mean, you know, they used to at least pretend, the Democrats used to at least pretend they were for the working person. You know, now they pretend they're for the middle class, and they're actually for the wealthy. So, you know, I mean, he's done a very Obama and his people are very shrewd. They do know what they're doing. They do know how to manipulate people. They do know how to hide information from us, and they do know how to get information on us. They know what they're doing, and they've become very good at it. I mean, I think they're even better at it than the Republicans are. You know, the Republicans led the way as far as mass mailings and far as, you know, getting online and all of this. I think the Democrats, as a party for the wealthy, have caught up and surpassed the Republicans in that kind of organization. I think Obama gets a lot of credit for it. I think Clinton gets a lot of credit for it, too. But it's not a working person's party anymore.
Well, Bob, this is going to end our grading process, and then what I want to do is, what would you give him in regards to leading his party, 1 to 10, 10 being the best?
I'm going to have to just say that doesn't deserve a rating because it's too – you got to look
at
it.
Rating, it's important that I get a rating on this so I can keep everything in perspective. So
okay. You know,
I think he has done well leading his party. He hasn't done well as far as leading the nation. And when I say leading his party, he's done well of leading his party, which is the Democrats and the Republicans. The way I see it is one party with two names, you know.
Right.
So I would say leading his party, I would give him like a he leads more for Wall Street rather than for either of those two sides of the aisle. So I would give him basically a 4 there.
Okay.
So
yeah, I would have said 4 or 5, and
we
were generous before. So
where we come in with the grading process, he's right at 1 out of 10. He's right at a 2.7 at this point, the scoring process for his leadership. But, Bob, what has been the president's best accomplishments, and what would you say has been his worst? And we have just another minute and a half for you to sum this up.
His best accomplishment may be the gay rights is probably the best. I mean, and I think that took courage on his part, too. The worst, and I'm kind of bringing this in because of the person he is, you know, as a black man, as somebody who's recognized as a black man. I think he could have done a hell of a lot more to combat racism. And I think he started out strong with the beer summit. Remember that? I think he started out strong. He was ridiculed for it. And again, instead of confronting the ridicule, instead of opening up the dialogue even further, he backed off. And he listened to the ridicule, and he almost was seemed like he was embarrassed by the ridicule, so he stopped. So if we're talking about, you know, the biggest disappointment as far as what I think he could have done as opposed to what he did do and has done, that would probably be it. Possibly be it racism. This country seriously needs to have a big discussion on racism, which we're not having. I think he tried to salvage us a little bit with the Trayvon speech, but I don't think it was enough, and I think it was too late to do it. He should have done it before that.
I think where he has done the worst has been taking this nation into wars throughout the world, and basically he has put the lives of everyone. No one is safe on this planet now. Under this administration and this government. Bob, once again, I'd like to thank you for joining the program. Bob, how can people reach you? And we really appreciate having you come on every time. How can people reach you?
Facebook, Bob Maschi, M-A-S-C-H-I.
Bob, thanks again, and I can look forward to having you to join us again in the future, correct?
Thanks, Stuart, yes.
And Bob, very quickly, do you still have your program?
I'm waiting to interview you.
Oh, just let me know when. I'll be ready. Thanks again.
All right, we'll talk.
Have a good evening, folks.
All right, see ya.
The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Welcome to the Research Rabbit Hole. Tonight we have special guest Siddiqui Bakari speaking on the topic of transhumanism. And Siddiqui spoke at the ParanoiaCon this past weekend and did a fabulous job, so I definitely wanted to have him back on my radio show. So welcome, Siddiqui.
Greetings. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm so excited that you're on my show, and I can't wait to hear what you're going to say.
Well, thank you for having me. Greatly appreciate it.
Yes. Well, in the conference, you were actually speaking about the, transhumanism, which ties in with the topic that we've been covering on chemtrails, blending man and machine. So I'm looking forward to you discussing that more in depth and filling my audience in on that, because as you probably know by the name of the radio show, we try to go further and further down the rabbit hole and explain topics that a lot of my audience may or may not be familiar with. But I'm just trying to do an overview and fill in as many topics as I can that spring off the subject of chemtrails and that tie in with such things as transhumanism and other things that that I found out about on this, you know, grand search through the rabbit hole. So I'm glad you're here. And how would you like to start this? Because it's kind of a really interesting and deep topic. So I'll let you start. And, you know, you did a fabulous job on your speech.
Okay. First, what I would like to do is I always give honor, and reverence for the ancestors. So I must always do that as well, honor and reverence for my mother and father, if not for their DNA and their spiritual technology, I would not be here and be able to do what I'm doing. So them bringing forth the thought of me existing, and of course me bringing forth the thought of me existing, is the reason I'm here. So I'm grateful for that and to them. Also, two of my teachers I must mention. Number one, Ashwaukwesi, who, in my opinion, is probably the greatest African historian that we have today, and probably one of the, if not the greatest historian on the planet in regards to dealing with African history. As well, Steve Coakley, who has passed on to the ancestral realm, who was one of the greatest teachers from a standpoint of dealing with politics, New World Order, Illuminati, secret societies, Boule, and things of that nature, and also being a strategist. So I have to first give honor and reverence to all of them before I move forward. So now that that has been done, before we get into transhumanism, just as I did at the Paranoia Conference, and the Paranoia Conference was powerful, and I want to thank Ron Patton for inviting me to the Paranoia Conference. Very powerful conference. Also, it was a pleasure meeting you there as well. Just your interaction and input during the presentation really helped, you know, bring a higher energy in that presentation. So I want to thank you as well.
Well, thank you.
Before, Absolutely. Now, we're going to get into transhumanism, but first, as I did in the presentation, at ParanoiaCon, we first have to lay a foundation and deal with spiritual technology, first and foremost. So when we deal with spiritual technology, we are talking about the essence of who and what we are as humans, okay? So in saying that, we're not just dealing with spirit or the emanation of energy. We are also, or animation as well of energy, we are also dealing with our blueprint. So we're talking about a biological blueprint, a neurological blueprint, and whatever other blueprint you can think of. But that blueprint is necessary in order for the notion of transhumanism to exist and even going into so-called singularity. And I will explain those terms in a second. So when we deal with spiritual technology, we deal with this from an ancient perspective. Okay?
Okay.
All over the planet, so-called indigenous people, we see the manifestation of spiritual technology. Now, what do I mean when I say that? What I mean is we see a overstanding of how to interact and interface with not only the human self, but also nature, animals, the cosmos, and so on and so forth. So when we deal with spiritual technology, this is what we're talking about. The human is a spiritual internet, okay? In overstanding that, the cosmos as well is an internet. These are archetypal essences, all right? The cosmos is an archetypal essence, primordial essence. The human is an archetypal primordial essence as well from a standpoint of our processes, from algorithms to things of that nature, okay? So we have to understand that. The human body is an algorithm in how it operates, okay? So we must understand that first. Now, in understanding that, we know that, let's use the Dogon, for example. The Dogon was able to download information from the cosmos. So we're talking about a form of intelligence, all right, that was being interfaced with from the cosmos, as well as other dimensions, but we'll just say the cosmos for now. So in dealing with the cosmos, what type of intelligence were the Dogon and many others, the Koori or so-called Aborigines and many others around the planet, what were they able to do in downloading this information? They were able to understand how to interface with nature. When do you plant particular fruits or vegetables or harvest fruits or vegetables? How did they know when exactly this was to happen, what time of year, and so on and so forth, how the cosmos relates to them as emotional beings, to them as their consciousness, so to speak. So this is important, first and foremost, in understanding what transhumanism is, or going into this essence of what is promoted as transhumanism with Western psychology and Western science and biotechnologists and neurologists and things of that nature. So I wanted to start there because, first and foremost, in dealing with transhumanism, what are we talking about? We're talking about technology interfacing with humans.
Yeah.
Or divine beings, soul beings, whatever term someone wants to use. This is what we're talking about. So how can this take place? This can take place in many different forms of technology. Artificial intelligence, information technology. In essence, this is all information technology. This is all intertwined. It's all connected. We see everything holistically as a African-centered or approach to research. So I must say that first. In my 20 years of research, it is from an African center, and we see it holistically. So I have to say that. So all of this correlates in the research and how this research is brought forth. So when we deal with information technology, what are we dealing with? We're dealing with the internet, this global worldwide web or network, so to speak. What else are we dealing with? We're dealing with just computers in general. We're dealing with telephone networks, fiber optic networks, so to speak, Wi-Fi, satellites, and things of that nature. All of this is in relationship to a transhumanist agenda, because this is what the human is interfacing with. This is what is also called cyborg anthropology. This is also called cyborg anthropology. So what we see now is a second self, so to speak, or an avatar self, so to speak, in interfacing with these different technologies, all right? Also, we have to understand that the technology, the external technology, when we talk about computers, artificial intelligence, and whatever other form of intelligence, synthetic intelligence, so on and so forth, inorganic organisms, all of those things are mimicking something that is organic. And this is, we have to be very clear. This is mimicking something that is organic. Let me give examples. So when we look at the computer, what is the computer mimicking? First and foremost, when we look at the human's body, biologically, neurologically, et cetera, the human has veins, correct?
Yes.
The human has arteries, correct?
Yes.
The human has some form of a solid base, bones, correct?
Right.
The human has a brain, or brains, excuse me, brains, correct?
One would hope, yes. Yeah.
Right. Also, neurons, which get into the neurological self, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so when we look at a computer, what does a computer have? Does a computer have wires? Yes. So what is that synonymous to? The human's veins and arteries. What else does computers have that humans have? Or what is it mimicking, I should say? Let's look at the human's imagination. And we're going to get into that. We're going to get into the imagination and the attempt to hijack one's imagination, because this is very important in where we're headed with the information. However, when we look at the cyber world, right, the internet, the World Wide Web, what we're seeing is this infiltration of the imagination, also the emulation and simulation of the imagination. And we know this from an ancient perspective. We've been dealing with the imagination and dreams and things of that nature. That's why I mentioned the Koori earlier, because we know the Koori is well documented of dealing with this type of high knowledge, so to speak, in dealing with imagination and dream state, things of that nature. So we have to be very clear in dealing with so-called virtual reality and how that relates to the imagination. See, this is a form of transhumanism that not many people are speaking of, because this is a form of transhumanism that's going to be most detrimental. When we deal with the imagination, when we deal with the spirit being and the soul being, okay? Because we do understand we don't have souls and have spirits. We are souls and spirits. We understand that. Now, let's be clear. Transhumanism is going to be used, and I've been on the record saying this. Transhumanism is used to, number one, desecrate the spirit and soul being, the divinity in a human. This is what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with divinity and desecration, or versus desecration, and we're also dealing with deification. When we deal with deification, now we're talking about deifying the technology, the inorganic technology, as opposed to deifying the organic, archetypal, primordial being, the ancestors, so to speak, our children, so to speak, our intrinsic essence, so to speak, our imagination, so to speak. And I've been on record also saying that the imagination is God. I use the term God loosely, but I know everyone will understand what I'm saying if I say God or have an idea. So, understand that the imagination is God. This is why it is necessary to come in and to desecrate and infiltrate one's imagination. And I'll stop there, and if you have any questions or a comment before I move on.
Well, I'm just wondering, you know, we're talking about a lot of really deep stuff, and, you know, our audience may or may not really understand what we're talking about with transhumanism, but can you kind of break that down and give it to us like in a fifth grade reading level? I come from an advertising background, and they typically say, if you can break this down to like the common denominator, which is about fifth grade level, then everybody's on the same page, everybody knows what we're talking about. So can you kind of break the term down to a little
We do have a caller.
Oh, you do have a question? Okay, good. What is the question?
Here, we'll just let the caller go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, my question is what you were just about to get into. I would like to find out if you can break down what you're saying into simpler components. And from what I'm gathering from what your guest is saying is that he's against the integration of humans with machines. So my question to you is, if science advances to the point where we can replace limbs, tissues, organs with manufactured tissue, plastic bones, and if we can extend life, let's say 200 or 300 or 400 or 500 years as a result, you're against that.
No, that's your comment. Now let me, and that's an excellent comment and question. Let me get into that. First and foremost, I'm not against anything. I'm for divinity. Let me first say that, okay? I'm for divinity. Secondly, I'm not against technology either. In regards to technology, it is twofold. We understand technology has agreeable purposes, and it also has disagreeable purposes. Now, when we deal with, let's look at the internet, and we deal with social networks and things of that nature, or email accounts and things of that nature, we are able to send out an invite to an event to 2, 3, 4, 5,000 people or more at one time. That's a benefit. Okay. Now, when we look at it from a standpoint of addiction, how the computer is addictive, when we look at the technology from a standpoint of how it affects the human biologically and neurologically, of course, that is a disagreeable aspect. When we look at historically what Western science has used technology for, is disagreeable from a standpoint of the pathology behind it, it being psychopathic, warmongering and things of that nature, using technology for evil, so to speak. Well, I'll say disagreeable because I really don't like the good and evil. So for disagreeable terms. In regards to dealing with particular organs in the body and things of that nature, really it is not necessary to have inorganic organs and things of that nature with the strides in regenerative science. So we don't need that per se. See, this is what we need to understand from a standpoint of the science itself. With regenerative science, those organs can regenerate themselves, stem cell research and things of that nature. So a lot of information on those topics. So again, we don't need the inorganic aspect of it per se. We can still be able to use the organic aspect of that organ per se. Now, I'm not against, let's say, prosthetic limbs and things of that nature if, you know, one is not able to use regenerative science and things of that nature. Then I'm not against, say, limbs per se. What we see in the media, we see the it's always being pushed from a standpoint of this technology. We see it in a format of a veteran, so to speak, who was in the military, who lost a limb fighting for this country, blah, 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 blah. We see prosthetics used for medical and things of that nature. I'm not necessarily against that. I'm not against technology. You understand what I'm saying? But what we have to be clear about is the technology that supersedes all technology is the archetypal, original, primordial technology. This is why there is an attempt to
mimic. Do you mind if I interject and just try to get this down to basics?
When I finish this point.
I think you've already talked about the primordial before.
Wait a second. Mm-hmm. Wait a second. Please do not interrupt me. If you ask me a question, allow me to further my answer, because really this is not a debate. This is an interview. So I'm addressing your question as best as I can address it, and then we'll go from there where the host would like to go. Does that make sense? Is that okay, Cynthia?
That's great. Yeah, I like to honor my guests. I didn't plan on taking a caller this soon in the talk. We were just kind of discussing about, you know, transhumanism and just getting clear on that exact definition where the whole audience can follow us. So we're not having a debate on that topic. We're just trying to make sure that everyone understands what we're talking about.
Okay, well, let's go back to that particular point in regards to transhumanism. Simply put, primarily transhumanism is the interfacing or intertwining of humanity and technology. Okay? Now,
okay,
when we say this, we're talking about many different aspects of human experience. I can already show, and I've already documented, the vast aspect of how transhumanism is already existing in the different aspects of human experience. So when I say that, I mean in the entertainment industry, we see transhumanism. We see transhumanism in the educational system. We see transhumanism dealing with the different sciences. We see transhumanism in what we see in media. So, I mean, we can go down a list from a standpoint of where we're seeing transhumanism in the many different areas of human experience, okay? From a standpoint of media manipulation, we also see this in several movies. And I really hope people, when they watch these movies, they understand what it is, in essence, that they're watching. And first of all, I really want people to understand something. When I deal with these topics, I'm not just dealing with research, okay, meaning books and videos and things of that nature. I'm not just dealing with that. What I'm also dealing with is what precedes it all, and that is spiritual technology. The intuition. Intuition is a science. Western technology would like for us not to think that or deal with that intuition. But intuition is also a science. Intuition cannot be taught in school. You understand? Intuition is something you have. Now, there are things that you can do, of course, to expand it, to be able to tap more into yourself, particular work you can do. But that's something that always need to be mentioned. Always needs to be mentioned. It's not just about book research and things of that nature. It's not just about, you know, the computation, so to speak, and the synthetic computation and things of that nature, but it's also about the essence of who and what we are. And that's what is beginning to speak at a higher rate and a higher level, because humanity is now beginning to really see what's taking place from a standpoint of manipulating our faculty, so to speak. We didn't even get into sixth sense technology yet and what that is, and how that relates to primarily framing one's reality, so to speak, or taking one's five senses out of the play from a standpoint of those senses are fully, integrating or interfacing with the environment. So that's a technology that's totally taking away or at least dulling those five senses. And at the same time, when we say sixth sense, the sixth sense, which is when we're referring to, of course, we're talking about now that that higher science, that higher vibration, the higher frequency, the pineal gland, and things of that nature, the first eye or third eye, as some people call it. Now we're talking about that type of intelligence, okay? So now we're talking about being the attempt to take one from interfacing with Akashic intelligence, the Akashic records, Akashic scrolls, Akashic imprints, and things of that nature, the super consciousness that exists in one's being or abode. So sixth sense technology is very interesting. They also have what's called sixth sense brain implant, which is supposed to be slated to be in effect 5 to 10 years from now. I'm pretty certain they already have it. We know whatever it is that they are promoting to the public or speaking about in the public is something that they are normally already 50 years ahead of, at least. But sixth sense brain implant will definitely be a tool used to be able to fully tap into one's imagination, to fully tap into creating a state of virtual environment as well as virtual reality or illusion, however you choose to look at it. And that's sixth sense technology. There's a lot of information on sixth sense technology. Let me give some people some the main scholars or academians on sixth sense technology. Pranav Mistry, he's the main person. His name is Pranav Mistry, and he's primarily the architect, at least from the research I've done, on sixth sense technology. It's very interesting, and it's also a woman named Patty Mays who is heavily involved in sixth sense technology. They actually work together. Very interesting. Naturally, it's groundbreaking because what it's saying is you don't need a computer anymore. You become the computer. Your body becomes the mouse pad, so to speak, or the computer board, the wall or whatever type of surface, you know, becomes the image, and then you have marker caps to create this image technology as well as a small projector, as well as a digital phone, and all of these devices are used to create what is called sixth sense technology. Of course, it will all be one device very soon. So sixth sense technology is something that people really need to deal with and know about as well, and then they can form their own opinion, so to speak, on what's happening with those technologies. From a standpoint of transhumanism, I want to give people some sources as well so people understand I'm not just some nut job that's giving you this information. You can actually find this information all over the place. There is a scientist named Ray Kurzweil. Ray Kurzweil has written several books. One of his books is The Age of Spiritual Machines, When Computers Exceed Human Intelligence. Another book is The Future of War by George and Meredith Freeman. Another book is by Hugo de Garis, which is titled The Artelect, meaning artificial intellect, The Artelect. So those are some books that you can look up, or you can look up Ray Kurzweil and the many others who deal with transhumanism and those different types of technologies, as well as singularity. And, of course, I've written 4 books as well dealing with spiritual technology, transhumanism, posthumanism, singularity, and the many other topics associated with that and how that relates to human experience. Those books, just so the listeners know, and you can go to my website, it's my name, Siddiqui Bakari, S-A-D-I-K-I, Bakari, B-A-K-A-R-I, SiddiquiBakari.com, www.SiddiquiBakari.com. I have my 4 recent books. I'm working on my 10th book right now. My 4 recent books is Computer Software, The New God, cyber consciousness and cybernetics in the epoch of spiritual transmigration interface. As well, we have hip-hop androids, artistic clones, and the portal of artificial intelligence. We also have wormholes, cybernauts, and holographic gods, as well as on the other side of fear is God, the primordial blueprint for divine manifestation. And the latest writing is entitled The Magnum Opus on Sacred Spiritual Technology, Akashic Interface, and the Singularity. And the Magnum Opus primarily, just so people understand, Magnum Opus is a book that primarily deals with these topics in ways that, at least from my research, most academicians and scientists are not dealing with those particular topics in the way that I'm dealing with. First and foremost, I deal with it from a perspective of the African in the diaspora, the divine human, so to speak. And feel free to go to the website. So those are all some sources. There's many more sources. They talk about, you know, these topics in Time magazine and, you know, on and on and on. Even the commercial media, if you go on their sites, all you have to do is go to the technology section and you'll find a lot of this type of information as well in regards to what they're dealing with. Even law, when we deal with transhumanism. Many lawyers and attorneys have been put together and given hundreds of thousands of dollars, well, probably millions of dollars at this point, just to figure out how can transhumanism fit under the construct of law. So primarily what I'm saying to you is, at some point, robots will have rights. rights that many humans don't have. You see? And I'm not talking about civil rights. I don't want people to mistake what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about civil rights. I'm talking about human rights, which most humans don't have in a corporation that we call the United States. This is what we're talking about. Also, we're talking about, as I spoke in the presentation in regards to programming and the different programs that run simultaneously and are all connected in regards to the gay marriage program, in regards to the racism program, and all these other programs that are running together that are getting folks ready for the next program, which is to come, in regards to the psychosexual aspect when we deal with gay marriage. That's a program that's getting ready people for the next step. Obviously, after gay marriage, what would be the next step? Possibly humans and animals having some type of marriage under the law. What will come next? Then we will start talking about humans and robots and that psychosexual type of behavior being part of law and marriage and all of it. And then when we look at human experience, we have to understand that that human experience is being mimicked. So therefore, what you see in human experience, you're going to also see in the artificial side of it, or the so-called transhumanist side of it. So we won't only talk about humans and robots possibly being able to marry 20, 25 years down the line, and there's much research on this. This is not something I'm making up. Also, we have to talk about robots and robots later on down the line having that same type of law being given, so to speak, as well as we have to look at polygamy as well. Polygamy gets thrown in the pot also, because if that's what we're seeing in human experience, we're going to see it as well from a standpoint of how it is being emulated or mimicked. And I know it may be difficult for some of the listeners to really grasp this, because I know it sounds science fiction. Be very clear, it's not. Nothing I'm talking about is science fiction. You see it in movies, you read about it in novels, but understand, this is real life. This is happening.
Yes.
What you see? Yes? Yes.
Yeah,
what you
definitely
see in movies? Absolutely. What you see in movies, that's not even an advanced state of the technology. Let me say that. That's not an advanced state of the technology. Whatever they are showing you, they are far, far ahead of it. Now, also, this is not to deify the technology. I want people to be very clear. I'm not deifying technology. I'm not doing that. I'm not deifying technology attempting to emulate consciousness. I'm not deifying that. I'm not deifying the attempt to emulate the soul. And I always say, if you know that you are a soul, what is the need or purpose to mimic it? If you understand what immortality really is, what is the purpose to attempt to stay immortal in a physical body, in a third dimension state? These are questions that we see. We understand this in dealing with an ancient perspective. And I have to keep going back to that for a reason. We're not talking about problem, reaction, solution programming. We're not talking about emotional programming. We're not talking about psychological programming. We're not talking about religious programming. We're not talking about any of those programs. And we have to be clear. Does that mean in ancient times it was just perfect and flowers? Of course not. Of course there were issues. But what we know is, based on what the ancients left us, we are very clear that there was a love for nature, the universe, humanity in general. We understand that. We're very clear. So I think it's pertinent that, I say that.
Cool. Okay.
And
earlier
also,
this week, I actually saw a mind control video that was put out by RT, and it was labeled Mind Control Remote Neural Monitoring with Daniel Eastland and Magnus Olson on Russia Today. And that was getting into the, you know, mechanization or like the remote ability of taking computer interfacing with humans and actually putting people into a super computer system and downloading their consciousness where basically they don't need humans anymore. They're just going to take everyone's consciousness and all of their knowledge and plug it into a computer base and then run that. So have you seen that at all? Have you seen that video yet?
Actually I have, and I'm very familiar with that
technology. What did you think of that?
Well, first, let me say this, because I want people to get it real clear. I know most of your listeners are involved in social networks.
Yes.
Twitter, Facebook, you know, things of that nature. As far as Facebook, a lot of folks are familiar with the owner of Facebook who they put in the forefront. His name is not coming to me at the time. You know his name right offhand?
Mark Zuckerberger?
Yes, Mark Zuckerberger, okay? That's who they put in the forefront. However, one of the owners of Facebook is Dustin Moskovitz. He's the co-founder. Now, guess what he does? Huh? He owns a company, and this company develops software that, quote-unquote, thinks like a human. This man is working on the replication of the human brain.
Wow.
Okay, now what does this have to do with Facebook? See, I know that's what people are saying. It's the reason Facebook has this timeline. And it continues to create new setups for its site. My portfolio is what I call it. Primarily, if you're on Facebook, any on the internet in general, you have a my portfolio. You have a file, so to speak. This is what Facebook is. This is why, as people are telling their stories in a chronological fashion, people are telling their what they're doing on a daily basis, the consistency of their lives. People are they are manifesting their emotions onto that network through their posts, statuses, and things of that nature. Okay? that is part of the process, as well as the photos, video imaging. That's part of my portfolio or my file as well. So what we're saying is that is part of what's being used as benchmarks to replicate the human brain, as well as in order to think like a human brain, you have to first deal with the aspects of the human brain, the manifestations, so to speak, of the human brain. So Facebook is a part of that. The Internet in general is part of that. And that goes into many other topics. But I'm saying that because that segues into what you're talking about. You're talking about primarily brain-gate interface or what they call, I mentioned it, the sixth sense brain implant, as well as that deals with, it goes into other ways of interfacing too. Neural dust, nanoparticles, smart dust.
Yes.
Psychotronic warfare, right? Memory,
right.
Manipulation, technology. So this rabbit hole goes deep. But I went through all of this so we can see how all of this connects. We have to understand it all connects. And that
yes,
is the main point I want people to understand. I want people to understand that it all connects.
Yeah.
Okay? Getting into the brain interface, okay, or brain gate. Getting into that, first, what is the platform to set up for that outside of the scientific aspect of actually making a brain, so to speak? You have to have, and this is primarily Martine Rothblatt, okay? This is the owner of Sirius Radio and many other companies with signals, and it has signals and things of that nature, okay? Martine Rothblatt, who was a man, who now is a woman, biologically changed himself to a woman. And I don't get into all that, but I just want people to understand, because remember, when we're dealing with science, in order to deal with science, and I don't care what type of science you're dealing with, the pathology or psychosis of man or woman will be influenced on whatever science you are dealing with. Be very clear. You have to understand that. Okay, now, he has what he calls his blueprint. He's a biotechnologist. He calls it mind files, mindware, mind clones. Okay? We'll go through all three. Mind files are already pretty much explain what that is, but primarily when we talk about mind files, we're talking about digital reflection, your digital reflection, pictures, images, things of that nature. We're talking about whatever type of meta information that you have or documentation that you have, emails, text messaging, whatever form of communication that can be somehow documented, whether written, voice, video, all of the above, those are part of your mind files, okay? In other words, remnants of your consciousness, okay? Mind files, your emotions, things of that nature. The attempt to simulate these things. Mindware. Mindware is the software that Martine Rothblatt proposes will be used. Okay? Mindware is simply the files that I've already talked about as far as mind files. Okay? Mindware are those files being created into some form of software, okay, to be used for a mind clone. Okay? This mind clone can be the actual body of the person who mind files have been turned into mind where. It can be the same actual person. They can preserve the body using cryogenic technology and things of that nature to preserve the body, and at some point possibly upload this information into this mind clone. It can also be a totally different body altogether, okay? This is the attempt to emulate and mimic consciousness, okay, and upload this consciousness into a human, okay, but not just a human. Also, working on being able to upload this information or cyber consciousness, because it's not real consciousness, this cyber consciousness into a actual robot. And you can look, Martine Rothblatt, you can find his or her works, and it's all there. The information is there. Also, what he talks about is this notion of immortality. He's big on immortality by using transhumanism. And, of course, that would get into singularity. But he's big into, you know, you dealing with immortality through transhumanism and creating this notion of God, okay? Me personally, different strokes with different folks, I understand that when we use this term God, that has nothing to do with anything ancient. That is a primarily a Germanic term. So we are dealing with that perspective of it when we deal with God. We are not dealing with a ancient or archetypal experience in dealing with this phenomena, I'll just say, okay? So primarily that is an experience that was created for the people at that time to emulate or mimic an experience that they were not able to fully partake in, period. So this is what's happening in science in attempting to create immortality, all right? Or attempting to create God. So that gets into brain gate. But then there's the neural dust and things of that nature. When we get into the nanoparticles and the chemtrails, as Cynthia mentioned earlier, so now we're talking about, you know, being able to interface with one's brains and neurons through the breathing in of these nanoparticles, you see? And this is this also goes into what's called Wi-Fi, Bi-Fi, or it's also called the biological internet. And the reason I'm mentioning these two things together is because we have to understand that now we're talking about foreign entities that work as parasites. This is primarily what they are. Work as parasites, come into the human body in order to manipulate the human body, control the human body, and there's other
Vicky,
purposes.
I think we've got a little bit of interference going on the phone. I don't know if that's the guy who called in, but I've been hearing dogs. I've been hearing some rambling.
That's not over here.
Is it not
that's
on
not
your
from
line?
Over here.
Okay, Ruthann, can we isolate that sound?
Yeah, close that line.
We're having an issue. I can barely understand him, and I'm on the line with him, so I'm thinking my audience is probably losing him too. So have we handled that?
Are we okay now?
Sounds like we're good to go. Okay, sorry about that. I just thought we needed
to clear up that on the line.
No.
Okay. So I wanted to mention the Bi-Fi and the neural dust or the nanotechnology, the nanobots and all of that. I wanted to mention that in the same genre, because we have to understand that when we deal with these external technologies of artificial intelligence coming into the human body, all right? Now, first of all, we know that the medical industry is going to tell us it is to enhance the body. Of course. We know how the drug administration works. We get it. Obviously, and I'm not saying that there cannot be a purpose that is agreeable for that to happen. However, we have a long history of understanding of what the case primarily is. So I'm speaking from a standpoint of what the history says. So until we find something different, we understand what it is, okay? So we're talking about these nanobots, neural dust, and things of that nature. the biological internet coming into an original internet. The human body is an original internet, coming into the original internet, and what is it doing? See? What is the purpose of it to come in? First and foremost, what is it going to do? It is going to interface with what? Cells, DNA, neurons, and so on and so forth, the brain, and whatever purpose that parasite or that nanotechnology is being used to assimilate into the body. And we have to be very clear about that. And I've read several articles about Wi-Fi or the biological internet and what science is telling us at Stanford, what they're telling us it will be used for. Okay? Of course, they're saying it will be used for augmentation. When they say augmentation, this is supposed to enhance the body. Well, I'm not saying that there's not a possibility. However, I'm saying, again, we know based on history, we don't have to go into all of the psychotropic experiments or the psychological experiments and MK Ultra and all of these things that's been proven not to be so-called conspiracy theory. Okay? We know that this is something that happened in Germany. We know that this is something that's happened, you know, all over the world. We know that German scientists came over to the U.S. They were commissioned by the U.S. to bring that technology as far as mind manipulation and mind control and things of that nature. That's well documented.
Yeah.
So we know that it is not conspiracy, okay?
Right, and they also hold U.S. patents, which is also not
yes.
a conspiracy theory when they go to that
yes.
type of trouble. Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. Great point, great point. So we see, you know, all of this interfacing taking place. So we see that the interfacing is taking place with the biological self in general. We see the interfacing taking place with our brains, so to speak, and our neurons, which receives and transmits information or data. So now what happens when you bring in these different forms of nanotechnology, nanoparticles, nanobots, neurobots, and all of these different things? Now, what happens when that artificial intelligence interfaces with those particular neurons? What messages are being sent, received, transmitted, so on and so forth? Is it disconnecting one from its interfacing with the cosmos, and the energy that's streaming in from the universe and other planets and other dimensions? And that is real. That is not conspiracy either. So these are the things that, you know, I make sure I put on the table, because normally you're not going to see it when you look at academia in regards to the information that they're putting forth with these different technologies. And let me say this. Many of these scientists are brilliant. Many of
yeah.
these scientists are geniuses. Ray Kurzweil is a genius, okay? He's a genius. However, we understand, again, there is a pathology. If that pathology is one of psychosis, okay, we know that that technology will lack a moral and ethical foundation. And again, that is, we can well document that easily.
Yes.
So I'll, if you have a comment or.
Well, I guess we should go ahead and go back to the question that we first took online about the transhumanism.
Mm-hmm.
Did we answer that guy's question? Do you remember exactly what he asked?
I don't remember the back part of his question. Well, I think I answered it. I mean, primarily he was proposing that I'm against technology and things of that nature. And see, listen, we have to understand something. When I speak of, and this is why I deal with it from an ancient motif first, when we deal with ancient cultures, and ancient cultures interfacing with the cosmos, in essence, that is transhumanism. But the difference is you are talking about a cosmos, which is something that, of course, is not inorganic, and a and humans, of course, that aren't inorganic. And I mean, I know people deal with all of the alien stuff and all of that, and that's great. I'm just simply talking from the human perspective on Earth, which we can fully document, and we're not dealing with theory or, you know, notions of Greek myth and philosophy or anybody else's Greek, any other myth or philosophy. Just simply put, ancient humans interfacing with the cosmos. That is a form of transhumanism, you see? But it is not artificial, and that's what we got to be clear on. It's not artificial. It is in sequence with the universe.
Right. Yeah, this topic is just so out there, and, you know, it does tie in with all this, you know, the nanobot technology ties in with
Absolutely.
Chemtrails, with transhumanism, and a lot
Absolutely.
Of people have not made the links with all this stuff actually coming together in with the chemtrail research
mm-hmm.
rabbit hole, but this is kind of towards the end of the research rabbit hole dealing with what I've been able to find out, along with Agenda 21 and some other issues. So there's
mm-hmm.
multi-dimensions to what really is
Absolutely.
Going on with the chemtrail issue, you know?
Absolutely. And let me say this as an ending statement. When we talk about this external technology, artificial intelligence, synthetic intelligence, so on and so forth, when we talk about that, be very clear. What science says is, well, humans are no longer so-called evolving, right? This is what they say. However, when we look at humanity and we look at the so-called de-evolution of humanity, first and foremost, we got to deal with science, Western science. What is Western science doing to desecrate humanity? What is being created? What is being created that desecrates the soil?
Oh,
which
gee,
is,
yeah.
Which is how we eat. What is being created to desecrate our air? So
mm-hmm.
if we're talking about a de-evolution of the human or humanity, let's first start with Western science, first and foremost. That is the issue that we have to deal with. And I'm here to tell you, so-called de-evolution, that is not what's happening. Transmigration is taking place as we speak. A spiritual transmigration is taking place as we speak. This is what science don't want the masses of people to know. 2012 is about this, and even before 2012. I want to make that clear, too. 2012 wasn't just this year where it all of a sudden, and now we can be these so-called gods and divine beings and things of that nature. This has already been happening. This energy has already been streaming into the planet. We have been receiving this energy, you see?
Mm-hmm.
And the government knows this. The government knows it, and that is why the food is being poisoned, the water is being poisoned. They feed you drugs and all of the above. Your medicine is drugs. It is artificial. It is inorganic, and it is killing the human body. It is killing the mind. It is killing the imagination. It is killing the very essence of what the divine human and humanity is, and science, Western science, knows it. And I'm making a distinction. That's why I say Western science. Okay? I'm making a distinction purposely. I want that to be understood. So look at it from a holistic perspective. Western science, Western academia teaches from a departmentalized form of education. It is not a holistic form of education. And we got to be clear about that. And this is why people are so fragmented and why some of them see the way they see or view or what their perception is in regards to what's going on out here.
Right. Yeah, we've got just a couple of minutes to wrap up. I wanted to thank you for being on the show. And if you could go ahead and state your website and contact information again, I'm sure my audience would
Absolutely.
Like to have that.
Absolutely. SiddiquiBakari.com. Siddiqui, SADDIKIBAKARI. That's www.SiddiquiBakari.com. There is a plethora of information on that site, not only dealing with transhumanism and singularity and those type of things, but also many other topics as well. And we definitely go down a rabbit hole. So please go to the site, and if the energy or the spirit moves you, order some
Very
of those
cool.
products. Thank
well,
you.
Thank you so much, Siddiqui. I really appreciate you being on the radio. Thanks so much,
I
and I look forward to talking with you again.
All right, peace.
Thank you, Ruth Ann.
Always. Good night.
Good night. Thank you.